Hi, everyone, and welcome to another Sunday Roast. We're back once again with two wonderful guests. Let's start off with Alistair. Alistair, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Hello. Yes, Alistair Barry, stand-up comedian, actor occasionally, writer occasionally, just done a new special called Woke in Progress that's just come out on Next Up, which I was very pleased with. Finished a tour, so haven't really got much to plug apart from that.
Fantastic. Matt, wonderful. Great to see you once again. Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Hello, yeah, nice to be back. Well, like Alistair, I've just finished doing a tour, so I also have nothing to plug in that sense. I've been, as you know, making videos online for a few years now, mostly comedy, satirical stuff. In fact, the last couple of videos I've made have been with Noreen Skinner, who I met doing this show. So that's a nice little circular thing there. Check out my videos, and I will be doing another tour, but not until next year, and I have written 0% of it at this point, so
I'm looking forward very much to seeing the Noreen Skinner videos, because I'm a big fan of you and what you do anyway, but I just wanted to let you know, when I saw Noreen Skinner on my phone from a distance, this is a terrible thing to admit, and if she will get upset, I do. I thought Noreen Skinner might have been a character, because it sounds like a name made up from a combination of Nadine Dorris and a number of other sort of MPs. And I was going, is he doing character work? And then I went, oh no, it's actually an act called Noreen Skinner. I do apologise. So Noreen, if you're listening, I can't wait to see it, and I'm very sorry.
And my wonderful co-host Alex, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Hi, I'm Alex, also known as Political X. I'm a journalist, historian, YouTuber, teacher on this show. Max, can you please introduce yourself?
My name is Max. I run the Rubbersphere channel, where I talk about British politics and Brexit in particular. And I have a special connection with Matt, because my live streams finish normally with a comedy moment, and I use one of Matt's videos. So I hope he doesn't mind that.
What?
It's all coverage, Matt. Don't worry. It's all coverage.
Alex, where should we start?
Well, there's a number of topics. There's Trump, there's Liz Truss trying to do another comeback, there's Israel. I did want to ask Alistair, how, in my research to have you on, how did you manage to get onto the Labour and the Conservative Party platform?
I am, as far as I know, the only comedian to play both the Labour and Conservative Party conferences. I did the Labour Party conference because a friend of mine was meant to do it and couldn't, and went, can you do it? And it was one of those, well, I turned up, it was at the Midland Hotel in Manchester, and I suddenly turned up to what was a huge corporate that I wasn't getting paid for. I just looked at it and went, this could go horribly wrong. And
where was then it? How long ago was this?
This was, Cameron was in charge, so it was early 2010s. Because I turned up and I was looking at it going, bloody hell. And then I turned around, Eddie Izzard was there. And I was like, hello. And he went, oh, are you on? And I was like, yes, are you? He went, no, I've done this before. I died on my ass. I was like, oh, good. And because Eddie's stuff, I mean, I grew up, you know, I think Eddie's a genius. But, or is it Susie now? I don't know what you meant to do. That kind of rambling Eddie Izzard stuff was not right for a political conference. I stood up and basically half the table of Coronation Street there, load of famous people, and I said, I've got some rude stuff about David Cameron, but I couldn't possibly do it. And they were like, do it. And it went very well, because I was just incredibly rude about David Cameron, so that was lovely. And I kind of came out of it going, phew. And then a few weeks later, my agent got a call and phoned me and said, damn, I've just had the Conservative Party conference on the phone, they want you to come and do a set. And my agent had said to them, you do know he's not really of you. And they said, yeah, apparently they'd seen a video of me online talking about Margaret Thatcher, and they wanted someone they disagreed with. So I said, don't be ridiculous. What's the fee? And they told me the fee, and I went, let's build some bridges. So I turned up to do it. And actually what it was for was, it was a fringe meeting for Forest, for the right to enjoy smoking tobacco. And I think we can although you wouldn't be so sure this week, having looked at what's happened with the smoking ban, opposition to the smoking ban. Oh, well, I think we can all agree that it's been fairly universally agreed cigarette smoking is not good for you. But having said that, Forest is basically a kind of libertarian in the good sense organisation, just saying, you know, you should have the right to do what you want, which I broadly agree with in a very much non-Lawrence Fox fashion. And so I had an agreed intro, and then there was a guy you may have heard of, James Dellingpole, who is the who's a right-wing blogger, kind of like a Lawrence Fox style journalist before Lawrence Fox was whatever, and just nasty sort of right-wing. And he stood up very odd and went, yes, sounded like Blue Bottle from The Goons. There's a topical reference for you. And he went, I think smoke. My children should be allowed to smoke. Yes, because then they'll find a cure for cancer. It's like, the f*** are you talking about? The most famous anti-smoker, Adolf Hitler. So that tells you all you need. And I was just going, what is... And the audience, I've never seen more maroon chinos in my life. And it was young men drinking claret. It was very odd. And James Dalrymple was dying so badly on his ass that he went, apparently they have some sort of comedian. He's some sort of lefty. Mm. And they all booed. And he went, where is he? Is he scared? And I was like, as Matt will know, you do not go on to that as an intro. I have an agreed intro. Do not introduce me like that. So I just stood at the back, at which point the guy running the thing came up on stage and went, fuck off to James Dalrymple. And did the agreed intro and said he is actually a Labour Party member. And I wasn't a Labour Party member. I walked on the mat. I'm not actually a Labour Party member, but I did do their conference, which got a big boo. And I went, I have to say, you pay more, which got a massive cheer. And then I went, which I think you'll find technically means they won. And they were like, oh. And then actually proceeded to have a really lovely gig because, you know, when all said and done, it was a crowd of people in front of me and took the piss out of James Dalrymple, which I think everyone enjoyed apart from James Dalrymple. So that's, a very long-winded way of saying I have performed at both. I'd very much doubt I'd do the Tory party conference again, but there we go. Depends how
and you could do the Lib Dem conference in between in like a bus shelter or
how are you both? Yeah.
Matt, would you do the Tory or Labour Party conference if you were invited?
Do you know what? I don't think I would, because I think I have slightly less thick skin than Al does in terms of going to a gig that I know I'm going to have not a fun time at. like corporate. I mean, I have done a fair number of corporate gigs over the years, but I tend to be slightly selective in the setup and who I'm working for if I can. So I don't do loads. I think in a funny sort of way, though, I think probably the Tory party conference would be more fun for that reason, because it's like, because there's something fun about going to a gig where, just to sort of contradict what I just said, there is something fun about going to a gig where you go, well, this could be awful. So sort of, in a way, there's no, like, I've got nothing to lose. Like, this might be the worst gig in the world, but I know that going in, so whatever. There's also something always slightly terrifying when someone goes, oh, you're doing that gig, that's such a lovely gig, you'll have such a lovely time, because that always makes you think, well, I'll be the one who doesn't.
Yeah,
you know, that, you know, then the expectations are too high and then you feel like, oh god, I could have a terrible one. But turning up at a gig, you know, I'm sure Al would agree with this, that you turn up a gig and it's just raucous and there's like people, it's really, you know, the other acts are having a tough time, you think, well, yeah, I've got nowhere to go but up from here. Like, if I have a terrible gig, then we all had a terrible gig. But if I somehow manage to turn it round, then I've done pretty well, and that's exciting. Whereas if you turn up and everyone's like, "Oh God, everyone's had such a great gig, you'll have a great gig," there is that slight part of you going, "Yeah, I hope I don't mess this up."
If I'm the one who doesn't. I think the other thing, though, which I would add to that, is that from a sort of marketing point of view as a comedian, when I first signed him, he went, you did both those conferences, that's brilliant, we'll put that on there because it's something that sounds good.
Yeah,
actually, when it comes down to it, doing the Labour Party conference and the Conservative Party conference are both talking to slightly odd people getting pissed in expensive hotels. And so the actual difference between them is not quite as established as it might seem from the outside in terms of a stand-up gig, because at the Labour Party one, I was taking the piss out of David Cameron and that was like, he's the bad man. Whereas in the Conservative Party one, I was taking the piss out of David Cameron and they were like, oh, look, he's having a pop at the leader. So it wasn't actually that dissimilar. It was still basically party activists getting drunk in a reasonably posh hotel.
That's amazing. I love how you could reuse your material like that. That's... It still says something about the parties, doesn't it?
Well,
I think in a way it would be harder to play like a very left-wing conference, you know, a sort of momentum conference or a sort of stop the war conference or something, because those people are very you know, they're very politically engaged, but they're also quite humourless a lot of the time. And they're certainly quite humourless about their own cause. You know, you couldn't go up and sort of take the piss out of them because that, because they're used to having that done all the time. So they've, there's a kind of slightly bunker mentality there. So if you went up and sort of like, oh, you guys don't really know what you're talking about, they would really be upset about that. Whereas I think if you go to a, I'm sure, yeah, if you go to a sort of big conference, it's like going to a corporate gig for a big company. It's quite easy to have fun with the company, to sort of take the piss out of the company, because everyone knows, yeah, no, we all understand that this is a big company and yeah, these things happen. But if you go to a small company, there can be a slight feeling of like, don't, you know, don't be horrible to us. Like, you know, we're you know, that, or not as in like in a sort of fearful way, but in a kind of like, you're being rude, don't be rude, you know. And I think that that, yeah, that I can see that with politics. Yeah, if you went to a very, very left wing or very sort of kind of full on Eurosceptic UKIP type event, they would have not, they would have not enjoyed you being kind of mocking of them in a way that you might have.
I think, I think you're absolutely right. I think, I mean, like, if you say like this, when you said the words momentum conference, I sort of, my sphincter immediately clenched at like the idea. Cause you know, I mean, I was on stage the other day, just a little club gig, and there was a South African in the audience. And I went, oh yeah, nice one on suing Israel. I thought that, you know, when even the South Africans are accusing you of being racist, you know, you're in trouble. And basically, you know that that gag, if you did it in the terms, would be going, oh, so you support genocide, do you? And you go, no, I was just having a go at the Israelis. But just the very mention of something will make them go, oh, no, you can't possibly. Yeah. So
the air goes out of the room in that situation, doesn't it? Like, I've seen that happen a few times recently. And yeah, it just, if you mention a subject which is a very hot topic and you don't have an immediately brilliant joke about it. And even some days, even if you sometimes do, even then it can still, the audience just like they switch, like they kind of go, nope, not, this is not what we're here for. We don't want to listen to this, you know?
Do you remember when when there was that whole incident with John Terry? I know this is segueing to football, but it does link into comedy. When John Terry had that altercation with Rio Ferdinand's brother and it was accused of using the N-word and the FA got involved. And then there was this whole anti-racist campaign. Do you remember that the FA then had their award ceremony and the person they got on was Reg Hunter, who was literally doing an entire set at the time, which involved extolling the virtues of using the N-word and how it should be used.
Yeah.
The one gig that universally I have heard, do not do this, no matter how much money they offer you, is anything to do with the PFA. And I mean, I think Rod Gilbert had a horrific one. Someone else very, very good had, but Reg, I mean, every one of his Edinburgh shows is called something and the N-word. And then and they acted surprised. Oh, and tell you who else had a dodgy one was Ian Stone did one. And basically, I can't remember, it was a joke that he's been using for years that is, I would say, not bland. Ian's a brilliant comic, but it's inoffensive. But so, I think it was about German. He's got a joke about if football managers, I'll paraphrase it badly. The joke is basically every bloke thinks that they're good at something they've not done because they've watched it on telly. So everyone thinks they'd be a great football manager. If that was the case, I'd make an excellent lesbian lover. I think that was the joke. And they, some woman went, that's a disgust. And you're like, you humorless. But it is basically, The problem is, if it's your gig, like I did a theatre gig in Christchurch last night, very sort of slightly Tory town, and I was doing stuff about Mark Menzies, about, I did Rwanda, I did Brexit, I did some stuff about my wife's breast cancer, and you could feel the intake of breath, but it's my show, and I'm trusting, and they trust me to do it well. If I was being paid to do somewhere where they were the corporate entity, not wanting me to touch those subjects, I haven't got the control of it being my show, and I can't turn around and go f*** off if they don't like something, as I did on a couple of occasions last night, where we're all kind of in it together. So if I go f*** off, it's a joke, and they're like, yeah, fair enough. In a corporate environment, that is very different.
It's just because on the outside, it seems like comedy is getting smaller and smaller, that the number of topics you can talk about are getting more and more limited. Is that true? Like you're saying about if it's your own show, you know, you have complete freedom or pretty
absolute. Much. With all due respect, Max, and I don't mean this to you personally, but I think that's utter talks, I think you can talk about anything. And Matt will get this as much as I do. People coming up to you and going, problem is, right, these days, oh, the problem is you can't say anything, can you? Oh, everyone's so easily offended. And like, no, you can say whatever you want, but you have to be able to justify it afterwards. What is it that you want to say that you don't think you're allowed to say? I talk about the trans debate. Now, I'm neither am I a TERF, or neither am I, deeply of the belief that everyone is transsexual. Like everything in life, the truth is a dialectic. It's in the middle. And people get hugely, people will hate J.K. Rowling or they will love J.K. Rowling. Doesn't mean you can't talk about J.K. Rowling, just means you have to be able to justify what you say. And I find the idea that is so easily promulgated that comedy's getting smaller is the words you use. And I'm not criticizing you, because I hear that all the time. And it makes me quite annoyed, because you can talk about anything.
I think that's true. But with a couple of caveats, one of which is, I think it can feel like it's getting smaller because we're all in echo chambers now. And so it can feel like you're listening to the same point of view, and I never hear anything the other side, but that's probably partly algorithmic. Yeah. If you click on something which is anti-Tory, then you'll start seeing more anti-Tory stuff and vice versa. And people can think, therefore, that, you know, if you have some right-wing comedian who does very well and people like his stuff, then they might come onto one of my videos and go, oh, you know, what's this? This is rubbish. But it's like, well, that's fine. This bit's not for you, but it does exist. And therefore you can't say it's not happening. It's just that, I'm talking about stuff that you don't like. And I think the other caveat I'd say is that, yeah, of course you can say whatever you like in a club environment. Obviously on telly and radio and things, there are different rules because there always have been, but also it's about being funny. It's about whether the audience you're in front of is enjoying it. So if you go to a gig where they aren't interested in politics, if you go and do a whole lot of politics stuff, they may or may not enjoy it. If you might find a way of getting them to enjoy it or not. But that's sort of your job as the comedian to work out whether that room is up for that or not. And sometimes you'll get that right. Sometimes you get it wrong. But yeah, if you go off, if I went on stage and told a whole load of mother-in-law jokes from the 70s, some people in the audience would like that, but quite a lot of people in the audience would be like, this is pretty hacked now, and this isn't really the kind of thing we want to listen to anymore. And vice versa, if I went up on stage and, or if another comedian went up on stage and talked in quite a lot of detail about their sexuality and their trans identity or something, again, in front of an audience in London or somewhere, or in a big city, that might get a huge response and people love it. And then other places, they might be like, this isn't really what we're interested in. We want to hear something about the difference between men and women, or, you know, cats and dogs, or whatever it is. And so I think comedy has always been...
Well, they're identifying as cats now, Matt. I don't know if you've heard.
Well,
it's absolutely
quite
horrific.
But that's the thing, isn't it? The comedy has always been about the audience in front of you. And I think when people talk about, you know, comedy's changed, there's a sort of lack of understanding that the audience has also changed. And so I think, and you know, you listen to, and Al knows who these people are, and I'm not going to mention any names, but there are certainly some older comics, older, probably male, probably white comics in, I'm very aware that that's what we all are, but there are people, you know, in dressing rooms around the country who'll say, oh, you know, I used to be able to talk about blah, 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 and now I can't. And I'm always like, yeah, but that's because you've not moved on and the audience has. You know, you're still talking about stuff that was funny in the 90s, but maybe that isn't funny anymore, you know, and maybe also you're not funny doing it anymore. Like, if you talk about going around
absolutely brutal.
But it's true.
I think if you're not interrogating your own stuff, that's the kind of point I think Matt's making, that if you're not looking and critical, there's stuff I've said in the past, which I now reconsider how I would say it. I think it's quite interesting, for instance, like words you can't use. I mean, people, you can't say anything these days. Basically, quite often, I mean, you can't even be racist. What's wrong? Well, I don't know why I did that in a generic Northern accent. I apologize. You can't even be racist. Why do you want to, you know, the N word, you would probably, I would never have imagined using it on stage in my career, possibly as reported speech, but very rarely. The P word people would have used, but that's now becoming less. And I had conversation with someone the other day online who you talked about Tottenham Hotspur and used what we'll now call the Y word very freely. And what was interesting is how it just sort of hung there as like everyone kind of went, that's not okay, really, is it, the Y word? Because it's a pejorative racial epithet. And so language develops. And if you go, why can't I go on about the Y army? Well, because it's 2024 and we are coming to a realization that that's not okay. Because language develops.
I guess is if you just want to stick with that type of comedy, you'll end up, I don't know, as a host on GB News or something.
Yeah, there is an audience. There will be an audience for some of those people. And there are definitely some acts who will, and there are people who I never ever see on the circuit because they don't really play the circuit because they have a different circuit, you know. And the sort of the working men's club circuit doesn't really exist anymore, but there's a sort of variation on that. There's a different sort of circuit out there. And I see adverts very occasionally will pop up on social media and it'll be like, you know, so-and-so, he's the most offensive comedian in the world. And I think, God, I've never even heard of him. And I look at his videos and it's basically kind of Bernard Manning kind of stuff, but just without the really strong racial stuff in it, but essentially quite, you know, Roy Chubby Brown-esque things. And he's obviously making a good living somewhere doing pubs and clubs around the country, but we never come into contact with each other. So that's what I mean, that he might think that, well, you can't say anything these days. And I might think, well, you can say anything, but it's because we never see each other. You know, we're never.
And he couldn't say what he would wanted to say at the sort of gigs that you and I would play. Funnily enough, I went on a cruise a couple of weeks ago, not to work, but because they've got a kids club and I got rid of my children for a week. It was f-ing glorious. they had, because I've been asked to do cruises by this company and I've said no, because I didn't really. And it was quite interesting because the comic, I went to see him, and I didn't know him. And he stood up and went, oh, it's nice here, isn't it? They've these curtains. Honestly, last time I saw curtains like that, we never saw Grandad again. And I was like, wow, really? I mean, that's... And he went, yeah, but if I die, when I go, I want to go like he did, peacefully in my sleep, not screaming like all the passengers on his bus. And I was genuinely like, oh, come on. I mean, that is
Monkhouse.
Stone age. But the funny thing that they do, and this is what Matt alludes to, is that they have an adult show later in the week and they go, oh, come on Thursday night at 10:30, don't bring any young ones, it's the adult. And it's kind of sold as blue, and I couldn't do that because I don't have a blue show. I might swear a bit more, but the very idea, and I have to be honest, I was watching it, bless his heart, this bloke, he makes a living, as Matt says, but I was watching it going, it wasn't going brilliantly, it wasn't great. They're trying to up their game as a company. If they're trying to do that, then they need to offer me the money I've asked for and they need to not bill me as blue, because but there is still an audience. I mean, in terms of what Matt was saying, I had something very interesting the other day. I was emceeing the Gong Show at the Comedy Store, which is a strange gig because there's about 100 people with various levels of mental disease. And most of them are on, to be honest, but there was a comic called Dee Allen who is trans, and Dee got up and I didn't know, but I introduced her, she got up, and I have never ever felt an audience. It was the sort of thing GB News UKIP it would loathe. The goodwill in the room was overwhelming, and when you go back on, the audience so desperate to like it that it makes it actually really hard to play because they're just, everything's off. And she and I was just, as the most experienced comic in the room, I was looking at it just going, oh, just please be good, that's all that matters. And she had this beautiful joke which I will now murder, which is the problem she has when she goes to the toilet, she can see people looking at her. It's a bit like when people see robots doing surgery. They know it's the future, but that doesn't mean they have to like it. And I was like, oh, what a great joke. And huge laugh of relief and everyone going, thank, because it would have been awful to have been liked because she was trans. It was great she was liked because she had a great joke.
It's interesting to look at this in a bigger perspective as well, because you mentioned that the audience is changing. And and we'll tie this in, it segues very nicely into Trump, actually. So we've got this sort of revisionist thing taking place. And in fact, last week we brought it up. I hadn't twigged this, but in Dambusters, the dog is called the N-word because it's a black dog. And there's been pushback about I think certain channels changing that. I don't know who brought
it. It's called the N-word because that was Guy Gibson's dog's name.
Yeah.
Which is where you get in a difficult area.
Yeah.
And if we lived in a post-racial world, then maybe we could watch a film like that and go, yeah, they used to call their dog that. But unfortunately, the word's got so many connotations that it's difficult. I think it's difficult. My father will be going, why can't you just say it? So, you know, you have to appreciate their points of view.
But then that comes in with the revisionist stuff. So people, I work as a historian. I'm looking back at history and going, that's really messed up. So, for example, I could turn around. I mean, there's any number of different things we could bring up. But one that strikes me the most, I was doing an A-level paper, and it was talking about the Opium Wars. So the UK used to sell so much opium that in 1 year, we sold more opium than Escobar did in his entire life. But we were
the good guys.
Yeah, we were the good guys. So in the book, it was debating whether or not the Opium Wars were a good or a bad thing. So are we going to have a debate about whether or not Escobar was actually a good guy and he was just misunderstood by the Colombian and American public? Selling that cocaine was like a neoliberal wet dream for someone like Liz Truss. I don't see how you can look back on that stuff without going, that's really messed up, and there's the line. And so there's this thing of within comedy and you saying that the crowd's changing. People are looking at things differently because they're looking back at history and they're going, actually, 50 years ago when they were doing that, or 100 years ago when they were doing that, that's messed up. But the education system at the time had never caught up. And that's why you're beginning to see these changes. So like that thing with the Opium Wars, I actually reported to the company that produced the book and said, you've got to get that out. You can't have a debate about Escobar being a great cocaine dealer or a bad one. And I think that's why we're getting this pushback.
Why can't you have that debate?
I was gonna say, I love that debate.
You would have a debate on whether or not opium was good?
Opium. I'm talking about Escobar myself. But
oh, you'd have a debate about whether Escobar was good.
Have you ever read Freakonomics?
Yeah, I read it.
Go and read. Basically, drug dealing is an almost entirely capitalist wet dream, as neoliberal wet dream, as you said. It's supply and demand. This is one of the things that makes me laugh so much about people like Truss and this mad free market economics. And then they suddenly go, Escobar, evil. You go, Escobar is literally doing exactly everything you want. There is a demand. He is providing it. He's working a very, very sensible business model. Unfortunately, due to the mad laws that you put on at the same time as allowing this thing, a massive capitalist system to go, he's become a criminal. Now, I'm not saying about whether cocaine is good or whether cocaine is bad. I'm saying the really interesting thing about the debate is the nature of free market economics. And so Escobar did give
that
a lot
we
of money
could
to
debate.
He also self-regulated. He wasn't controlled by the state. So
exactly, he's a Tory wet dream.
And he killed a lot of people, and that's terrible. But it would be easy to turn around. So do corporations. So the company, lots of corporations, maybe not as directly. But there are lots of externalities that happen. Pollution. All sorts of things going on. I don't think either of us are making this argument in a kind of totally good faith way. But I think the point is that you can.
Excuse me.
But I
think it's a really good, it's perfectly good faith, Matt.
But what you were saying, I was thinking when you said that, I think the problem we've got in, I feel like one of the big issues with the internet as a source of information and stuff is the sort of death of context that everything is flattened out now. And you see this online all the time, that someone will bring up this is a kind of silly way of talking about it, but someone will bring up a clip from a TV show from 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, and they'll point at it and go, look at this, isn't this bad?
You couldn't do that now.
You couldn't do that now. And it's always like, well, yes, I know, because this was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and they bring up a clip and you try and you sort of the judging everyone, judging everything by its own by a current context is mad. But that's always been a problem in history, but it feels like it's much more of a problem now because everybody is, because all the information's there all the time there. And like people, and you see this with what's been happening in the news with Israel Gaza, that there's millions of people around the world effectively learning about the conflict for the first time through what's happened now. And I'm not gonna go out there and say I have got the correct view on it. Obviously there are thousands of different viewpoints on it, but you see how people can cherry pick arguments and cherry pick things that they think are right, and they'll say, how about this thing that happened in 1972, but someone else will say, how about this thing that happened in 1943, and you know, how about this thing that happened in 90, and it's like, but they're just using it to argue a point. They're not actually trying to get a kind of genuine thought through, because anything they don't like they'll ignore, anything they do like they'll grab onto, and that's is that... this kind of very bad faith way of arguing, I think.
So there's two ways of looking at that, because you could bring in the context. So like Jacob Rees-Mogg had a debate over the Boer War and the concentration camps, and he was trying to suggest that the concentration camps. Yeah, I know.
Can I try and guess what he was? They weren't really concentration camps, and they were happy holiday.
No, you have to do the accent.
I'm sorry, they were not actually concentration camps. They were holiday homes for recently dispersed Boers and their families, which actually provided perfectly reasonable living standards in what was a very difficult economic climate.
I love the little touch, the glasses that you did there. It's all in the details.
Drama school trained, love.
This is the problem with political satire now. What you did there was actually pretty accurate to what he said.
South African concentration camps had exactly the same mortality rate as existed in Glasgow at the time. A good thing, but where else were people going to live?
Did
when
you
there
just
was
justify
all that
the use of concentration camps?
No, I didn't. I'm talking about the Boer War had people put in camps for their protection.
So
where do you go? How do you make comedy out of the stuff that they're actually saying?
Well, I think the problem we have at the moment is people like we are in a horrific situation where people like Mogg and Braverman and Truss, people who would never have got near the great offices of state, have been. I mean, Johnson has a lot to answer for that he got rid of anyone of any capability because they didn't back Brexit. I mean, these people, look at the cabinet look at what's happened in the last couple of days. But the interesting thing as well, I totally agree with what Matt says. Everything's there at your fingertips, which means that you can always find something to back you up or oppose. And it reminds me of that. It's a great Disraeli quote that he said to Gladstone, I think. He said, the honourable gentleman is using statistics as a drunk man uses a lamppost, more for support than illumination, which is one of the great political quotes. And I think that there's a lot of that going on.
It's a great heckle put down that.
Oh, that kills at the Late Show. But I think it's really important to remember time that there is also nothing new under the sun. I was reading, I mean, the stuff that some of these backbench Tories have got up to in the last couple of days. I mean, Mark Menzies, my favourite one, he was 10 years ago, he had to resign, or he was fired as a trade envoy or something, because he was found to have abused a Brazilian rent boy who he also attempted to get to procure illegal drugs for him. And his response was, some of these allegations are untrue. And I thought, my God, that's brilliant. And then, you know, this thing on Grindr with William Ragg and the phone, the getting the dog. This is insane. And then you suddenly think, Lord Boothby was having an affair with Macmillan's wife for years at the same time as going to rent boy orgies with the Krays. And was in the House of Lords, and he took the Mirror to court and won. A lot of this stuff has always, there's nothing new under the sun on one level. And yet at the same time, we're always developing and language moves forward. So it's a kind of weird.
And technology is a big part of it, isn't it? I've hugely raised the tone. I've just been listening to the Rest is History podcast this week about I think it was on recently about Luther and the Reformation. Have you listened to that? Yeah,
I am utterly addicted to The Rest is History, and I'm in the middle of the Luther one. It's amazing. I love it.
It's amazing. They're all great. I mean, I listened to the one about Cortez and South America.
Amazing.
I mean, unbelievable. It's fascinating stories. But the Luther one, I think, is so relevant, and they bring up the comparison, which is why I'm doing it. I'm bringing it up now that technology always causes revolutions, and you know, the printing press was arguably the big thing that caused the Reformation, really. And the internet is—we're right at the start of that. You know, and all the ructions, all the various things that are happening all around the world with Trump and populism and all that kind of stuff is clearly massively to do with the fact that we've all got the internet, so we can all just see anything we want online. Unfortunately, much of which is nonsense. And two, we've got social media, which means that you know, people, we can all sort of get together in groups that would otherwise never have existed before. You know, these people, mad people used to just have their mad opinions and that was fine, but now they can all find each other now. And then suddenly that's a problem, you know. That feels like a big issue.
I do think just to say, I too am very highfalutin and spend a lot of time studying history. But stuff like the Aztecs, which I just was a big hole in my knowledge. So it was amazing to listen to that. And the reason I'm mentioning another podcast on your podcast is the fact that it comes back to what we were talking about material. I don't necessarily agree with Dominic Stanbrook on a number of things. I think I'd probably have more fun with Tom Holland. But actually, no, I don't know if I would. I think the point is that they are both doing it with love, and that comes back to material. Mm. And the thing is, they are fascinated and engaged, so they can say whatever they want, and they're prepared to have a disagreement. But that is because it's coming from a place of really enjoying grappling with it. And I think that's really important with material. If you're just getting out and trotting out stuff that worked in 1994, there's no love there. If you're engaged with what you're doing, that will transmit itself to the audience, who will therefore give you a lot more latitude. Something Matt said reminded me of this, that if someone looks at one of his videos and goes, if you don't like the person, you're not going to find them funny. It doesn't matter what it is. You can show a video of me encoring at the Comedy Store, and someone who's decided they don't like my politics will go, that's it's not funny. And it clearly is funny to the audience in the room, but you're not going to make someone who doesn't like you laugh. And that's naturally going to happen. But I think the most important thing is that you love what you're doing and you can justify it.
So then that comes back. Sorry, I'm just going to bring it back to what Mog did, but also bring it back to this. That brings in critical thinking and education, which is so important to be able to have those debates. And one of the interesting things is you can look over at Finland, which does prioritize this type of education and has to in a certain extent, because it's got Russia on the border that would quite like to annex it. And Finland doesn't seem to be as affected by social media and all these new technological platforms. So there's an argument that education needs to step up. And the reason I bring it back to Mock, because he was misquoting stuff. He was even suggesting that people at the time weren't complaining about those concentration camps, that everyone thought it was the norm. Yet when I did a bit of research, I quickly found out that Lloyd George, he wasn't prime minister at the time, he was an MP, but a major prime minister was criticizing the concentration camps. And I think 40% of the deaths were under 16. But Mogg doesn't bring any of that up. So a lot of people, without critically evaluating what he was saying, would just take on board that and go, yeah, well, if Mogg's saying it and he's got a posh accent and he went to Oxford, must be true. And that's the thing that concerns me with the debates. Because when you when you brought up the conspiracy groups coming together, flat earth believers are on the rise. Oh, Alice has left.
Sorry, I was just getting some water.
I bring up flat earth and it just ruins everything.
The comedy police are at the door.
I hear discussions about Rees-Mogg and I need a fucking glass of water.
So you bring up flat earth is on the rise. I think it's like 15% in the US believe that the earth is flat. Do we need to be having a debate about that? Or is it just we need to sort the education system to get back to critical thinking to make them go, yeah, it's quite clear that the earth isn't flat.
We need to sort out, as Matt says, the internet has provided a platform for everyone to get together. You know, there used to be the mad bloke in the corner of the pub going, you know what? It's flat. And he'd be like, oh, Steve's off again. Now he's online talking to someone in the next pub and you're in deep trouble, which is why someone who's engaged and relatively articulate and relatively educated, like most of us are, is looking at Trump and going, this is absolute deep state. This is insanity. Look at Truss. This is, there was a conspiracy. You were the state, for Christ's sake.
She was the prime minister. How could you talk about the deep state?
I know. And, you know, we didn't see any of this coming. No, literally, you were. The thing is, I genuinely worry that the powers that be, the sort of, I hate to use the word elites, but the way the education system used to be was to teach critical thinking. It didn't matter so much what you were learning as how you were learning. And I think that has changed. But you have a big problem with, someone like Mogg is just, he argues in bad faith all the time. He is there going, well, you know, checks on the border would be an act of economic self-harm.
You're admitting that this could save £1 billion, which means that checks would have cost £1 billion. I thought post-Brexit checks were not going to be disruptive.
That's why we're not adopting them. This It would have been an act of self-harm if we'd gone ahead with it. It would have increased costs for people, and we are trying to reduce costs. So that's the purpose of not going ahead with them and trying to ensure that the border flows as smoothly as possible, which benefits everybody. Free trade.
It's like that's what you voted for in Brexit. I am very worried that we are creating a generation of people who are not thick, but badly educated, who don't, and then go, I've done my own research. You go, no, you haven't. You've looked on YouTube and found some dreadful people. I think there is a real problem with critical thinking, to the extent that you look at people like Trump and go, he's a terrible businessman. All of his businesses have gone bankrupt. Every time he ends up in court, he loses. Look at Trump University. Look at Jean Carroll. Look at all these things. He was the worst president you've ever had. He tried to over... And someone's going, well, yeah, you would say that. The deep state. And oh, my God.
There was an episode of The Simpsons where Homer was talking about his kids, and he says, the wonderful thing about kids is you can teach them to hate the same things as you hate. and I think people like Trump and others are able to say, look, I hate immigrants, or I hate foreigners, I hate this. And this is all these people care about. It's like, okay, he hates the same people as I hate, and he loves the same things. And they look past, you know, a bit like the history was, you know, ignoring the things that you don't like and just grabbing on to the things that you do. And I think it's with Trump. And I've always said, you know, people said, you know, well, he's going to be brought down because of this case or that case or what he said here or what he did. No, I don't see Trump being, maybe he'd be put in prison, but he'd still have his support. But I don't see him losing support with his base.
He's not going to lose literally
the base. Yeah, the base.
Base are properly insane. But don't you think
you think that's partly, I mean, I think, again, this isn't like an original thought, but that I think it's so important that, you know, it is basically polarization and tribalism is the result of all of this. And that has become, that's become the case everywhere. And I think the danger with what Al is that there is a danger in thinking that it's only sort of thick people who are the problem. I don't think it is true. I think, unfortunately, polarization and tribalism and conspiracy theories can affect anybody.
There
have been studies that show that people who are quite intelligent, that actually, weirdly, the more sort of academically intelligent people are, quite often they're more susceptible to conspiracy theory because they see something that kind of doesn't quite make sense to them, and then they go down a bit, and then that ends up. And then, you know, there are articles written by clever people who have a similar idea, and then they think, well, this is written by someone who seems articulate and interesting. And so I think it is a problem, isn't it? I think critical thinking is important, but there's another part of me that has... There is almost a part of me that has the opposite idea of, like, we sort of do need to teach people some stuff as well.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Facts. that's part of the problem as well.
I totally agree with that. And I think that there's, I think, and I hope I caught myself not saying the problem's thick people, but the problem is uneducated people. And then we come to, as you say, what's critical thinking and what's just facts? You know, you've got to establish that the earth is round. Can we just go with that's a fact? But some people go, I see what you've done there. But I think what's really interesting, and this you made me think of it just then, Matt, basically intelligent people who are given the kernel of truth, and this is the way stuff like a lot of the right-wing media works. I listen to my parents who are like, well, you know, I mean, the theatre now, you're not allowed in the theatre without a warning about Romeo and Juliet being, and that's not quite what's happened. What's happened is there is some literature outside that if you've got some concerns about mental health, there you go. But this is blown up into a big story. And you can almost cherry pick anything like, oh, in Brighton, you're only allowed to talk about chest feeding because there was a leaflet saying treat the trans and LGBTQ community with sensitivity. And
every time he talks about something positive.
sorry. Yeah, we're having anyway, I'm sorry.
But it's true of what you said. And I think people like Farage are very good at weaving both truth and lies. So he'll take something like, immigration figures are up, which is true. And then he said, well, this is the reason it's true, but this is the reason it's happening. And he's very good at, I think this is one of the reasons why he's so successful, is he's very good at mixing truth and fiction.
Oh, he's brilliant at it. I despise Farage with all my being, but he's brilliant at that as a sort of populist. But I mean, a very good example is the trans debate. My mum and dad, I've got a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, and my mum sits me down and goes, so what are they teaching them about the trans debate? And I'm like, they're teaching them times tables, mum. That's what's important. But because the Telegraph arrives on their doorstep every morning saying, oh, trans this, trans that, they're terrified and they think that's more important than learning your alphabet.
Do you get? Would you be tempted just to cut off their supply of the Telegraph and send them something else instead, just for a month, just to test and see if that did anything?
They're 80s. They're in their mid-80s. They've earned what they want, and they know what they like. I mean, the Telegraph used to be a great paper. It has now become so weird. I mean, Alistair Heath, some of the stuff he writes is just insane. And yet, because it's Telegraph and it's kind of, it's slipped into madness via respectability.
Yeah, so they slowly. Still go,
says here that, and you can literally read every day another story that goes, oh, come on. So extrapolating some out of something that was initially true. There's no nuance. That's the problem.
I've got a segue that I think maybe works in that sense, that because I think it's almost like the Fox News problem, though, that the thing about the Mail or the Telegraph things, these papers, it's not that they are, I mean, the Telegraph is slightly different, and the Telegraph has gone more and more mad because of the ownership and stuff, but particularly the Mail. It's not that the Mail is making people right-wing. It's that right-wing people read the Mail. And if you, or that sort of centre-right, you know, people who kind of soft right-wing or whatever. And so if you could somehow wave a magic wand and make the Mail left, people would just stop reading it. That's the thing. It would slowly stop. And it's like with Fox News, where Fox News had that moment after January the 6th, where they went, do you know what? Actually, maybe Trump's a bit not ideal. Maybe just we're just going to give ourselves a bit of wriggle room here, that maybe Trump maybe wasn't perfect.
That's a beautifully British take on the whole maybe not ideal is such a British version of the Fox News take. I love it.
But then, of course, they lost a lot of viewers to Newsmax and these other, you know, the even more extreme right. And so Fox has then been sort of trying to catch them since then. And so it's sort of, and you see this happen with Trump. Trump has become this kind of black hole sucking in all of the kind of sensible, you know, centre-right, you know, moderate Republican people. Because his base, as we've discussed, are so intense and are so on his side, whatever happens. And it's so not about reason and it's not about critical thinking. It's about, well, he makes me feel good. And he, as Max said, he hates the right people. Then anyone who's trying to make a sort of reasoned argument against him is just going to get blown away by it. There's just no, and the Fox News and people like that have to kind of keep covering him because that's where the views are. And if they started saying, you know,
well, GB News has tried the same sort of platform and it hasn't got the advertising money.
Yeah, because we don't have the same level of polarization in this country.
I was just going to say, it turned out last week that the government had put in £340,000 worth of advertising into GB News, which they're then on, and then they're paid for to be on by.
Well, I was going to say, to be fair, the Conservative MPs who work for GB News have to receive their salaries from somewhere, and it's not from advertising revenue from most people. But I think, it's a very different thing trying to do. I mean, they're trying to do the same thing. And, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, Matt. I've been asked to do GB News a few times, and I'm not going to go weigh in against people who have done it, but I've turned it down repeatedly because it's also, again, it's like, you know, it's not even, I mean, I don't want to use the words critical thinking, but it's like, can we make a joke about pronouns? Can we make a joke about that? And it's just real kind of, it's almost like a tick box of things that will, and they have to have one of the panelists has to be a bit of a shock panelist. And it's not really, it's a lack of good faith arguing. Having said that, it doesn't work in the same way as Fox News. The problem that they have in the States more than anything else is that no Republican has had the balls really to stand up and go, this is an absolute disgrace. I mean, okay, Liz Cheney, what happened to them? You would talk behind the scenes to almost any Republican outside of Trump's base and they would go, this is a nightmare. But they will not stand up because they know that the base will come down on them like a ton of bricks. They will lose. I mean, Cheney lost her job. And that's, unfortunately, the way that the States has gone is that there is no, and that's basically why democracy doesn't work. It's become a ridiculous reality style TV popularity contest as opposed to any kind of genuine discussion of views.
Well, as Alistair said, it's the, you can't criticize Trump, and we've seen anyone who does criticize Trump just disappear, not literally, It's not, doesn't have that power yet, but yeah, but you can't stand up to him, you can't call it out, and I would imagine there are many Republicans who say this is just a show, but they can't say it because it'll end their career, be it in the media or in politics. So
did you see that clip this week of the Republican senator, and I can't remember the guy, George Stephanopoulos was interviewing him, and he listed his things he'd done and said, you know.
So just to sum up, you would support him for president even if he's convicted in classified documents. You support him for president even though you believe he contributed to an insurrection. You support him for president even though you believe he's lying about the last election. You'd support him for president even if he's convicted in the Manhattan case. I just want to say the answer to that is yes, correct?
Yeah, me and 51% of America.
And you still support him? And the guy just went, so does 51% of America. And you go, that's your argument. It's nothing to do with anything but support.
But it's you've got the evangelicals that support it. But if you look at the Ten Commandments, I think he's breached at least half of them. So there's
he's a means to an ends for them. Yeah. They don't actually care about whether he goes to church or whether he believes in the Bible and believes in God.
It's also it's a misunderstanding of what the evangelical movement is. It's not a, you know, I think we in the UK have a slightly dangerous view of evangelical Christianity in America as being a bit like the Church of England or something. It's really not.
No, it's not.
It's a social movement, and it's incredibly sort of sinister in lots of ways.
Is he got some part to play in the rapture according to the evangelicals? Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah,
the rapture in the UK would be, oh my goodness, someone's had a rapture over the scones, Maureen. Look at that, whereas in the States, he's part of the Israel thing, you know, and when the Messiah arrives and you start going, you're basing your argument on, as Matt says, it's not the Church of England. It is a whole new ball. It's biblical.
It's kind of millenarian. It's trying to. It's apocalyptic. You know,
it's fundamental.
It has been to an extent.
Yeah,
it's extremely fun. Like so, he compared himself this week to Jesus twice. I think on Truth Social, he said he was going through the crucifixion of Donald Trump, which is just mind boggling. Then you've got carved images being made of him left, right, and center. I found one the other day of him carved out as a Buddha. Which is just...
Oh, yeah.
That's a comparison.
I was going to say, that's actually not carved. That's actually a life-size picture of him. But he did. He compared himself to Mandela as well, didn't he? And you're just going, there's a great picture last week of him. There's a number of these sort of terrible sort of American-style art things with Jesus, like, holding his shoulder as he's at the desk going, give him strength, Lord. And you're like, he's going to court for paying off a porn star while his wife was giving birth. Where does Jesus come into this? And that's, as Matt says, it's not Church of England. You're dealing with a whole ballgame that we don't really understand over here.
And the same kid who was being born at the time he was having the affair, he's now demanding that he goes to inauguration.
Graduation.
Yeah. Sorry. Inauguration shit.
Which would be later.
No, and also more people would go to the graduation, I think. But there is. Is he not? Am I not right in saying as well that if he does go to Barron's graduation, that will be the first graduation of any of his children he has attended? But he desperately wants to go.
But the judge hasn't said he couldn't go. He was slagging off the judge before the judge had made the decision.
He didn't go to the graduation of any of his children, which is one of the reasons that him making such a fuss about Barron is nothing to do with wanting to go, and all about, hey, this would look good to say I'm being prevented by this sham trial by crooked Joe Biden. It's entirely specious whether he wants to go or not. It's just another PR opportunity.
That hour flew by. Guys, thank you ever so much. We'd love to have you back on again.
Absolute pleasure.
Such a conversation.
Thanks so much, guys.
Always a pleasure.
If you guys enjoyed this, please click the like and subscribe button if you'd like more stand-up comedians on our show. Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Be sure to tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.